Channel 141, I'm Harold Fisher. We're talking all things D.C. tonight with D.C. Council Chairman Phil Mendelson. Lines are open and we're taking as many calls with your questions and comments at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Lawrence, calling from Maryland, actually. Give us a, tell me what's on your mind, Lawrence.
Well, I was listening to your show and I believe there's discussion about the council taking up a piece of legislation. I believe it's the right to die or something similar to that nature.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
And I think the council member mentioned that there are several other states that have enacted this type of legislation. Can the council member put a number on that for me? When you say there are several other states, how many states are there?
I believe there are five states that have it in the law, and there are a number of other states that are considering it. Oregon has had it on the books for, if I remember correctly, about
1997.
20 years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because I know Maryland was considering something like this, but it died in committee.
Yes, well, sometimes Maryland takes several years to pass legislation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and in terms of, I guess, sample size, it doesn't seem like there's a very large sample size when we're considering that there were 50 overall states, and we're talking about five. So this is something that's relatively new, even though Oregon has had it for the longest time, I believe.
Yeah, I don't agree with your characterization. I don't know that 20 years is new, and
well,
I don't think of it as a sample
longest,
size.
But in terms of states that have enacted it, you only have about five, right?
Correct.
Okay, so that makes it a small sample size, I would think.
Hmm. So, and what point were you trying to
well, the
reach?
The point I'm trying to make with such a small sample size, it's kind of hard to understand what any unintended consequences that may result from this type of legislation.
Well, I think you look at 20 years of what's actually happened in Oregon, and you get a sense of how many instances of fraud. You get a sense of whether the folks who are taking advantage of this are at the margins of society. And in fact, even though a number of the opponents said that that's who would end up being disproportionately affected by this legislation, the experience is just the opposite. It tends to be middle and upper income people. And I don't know that looking at one state in the record means that that's not a good evidence. It's 20 years of evidence.
And maybe, you know, one of the other issues or points that we made earlier is that, for example, Lawrence, if this issue were to come up in your family, for example, if you were the person who were terminally ill, it would be your decision. Is that correct?
Correct.
It would not be the decision of your family. It would not be the decision of a spouse. It would be your decision alone. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And to exercise or to not exercise that.
Well, I mean, a person in that situation, it's kind of hard to understand that it's solely their decision without any type of coercion. I mean, people are going to try to impose different opinions. I think an earlier caller mentioned that, you know, it's hard for someone to really pinpoint what a person's life expectancy is, even though with the great physicians that we have out there, you know, no one knows exactly when your time of demise is going to take place.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, Lawrence.
You know, doctors make mistakes all the time. You can tell a person they have 6 months. That 6 months could turn into 6 years.
Certainly something to continue to debate for the district over the next 2 weeks.
For such a final decision to be made, there is no exact science into predicting a person's outcome or life expectancy. Because once you make this decision, we all know that's final.
Well, I think that's...
Someone may tell you have 6 months and you act upon that, but how do they know that it's only 6 months?
I think that's a little too easy for you to say. Having gone through two parents, it was pretty clear when they were at the end stage. It just was. It was clear. It wasn't a guessing game.
Well,
you know,
I mean, but
my father.
Lawrence, let him finish making his point, please. Go right ahead, Mr. Chair.
My father, who died at 98, he had a routine. And that routine changed, and he had a stroke when he was in his 70s, and he lived another 20 years. And so the routine changed over the years, but still he had a routine. But when he was no longer getting up in the morning and no longer dressing himself, and his eating really just became apple juice, it was pretty clear that he had a few, just a couple of months left, whether it was 2 months or 4 months or 1 month, and there was an evaluation that he was eligible for hospice care. This isn't a, it isn't that much of a guessing game. You know, when he had a stroke, you could say, how long is he going to live and what are the statistics? And in fact, one of the consequences of the stroke was that there was a period where he was having difficulty eating and he had pneumonia. And I remember asking him whether he wanted all of the hospital care. And I mean, it was an opportunity for him to say, not assisted suicide, but yeah, I want to just, you know, live this out and not keep fighting. And he had a different view and lived 20 years, and that was his choice. But what the government has done by not permitting this is to tell people what to do. And I don't think that's right. It's not right for the government to substitute its judgment and to take away your choice.
Well, Lawrence, thank you so much for your input. And as I mentioned,
one last question.
Real quick, please. I've got a lot of folks on the line.
Okay. Who's the sponsor of this piece of legislation?
I believe it was introduced by or co-introduced by a half dozen council members.
That's correct. Although, council member, forgive me because it was off the top of my head and I did remember it. Forgive me because I had.
That's quite all right. I mean, yeah. I appreciate the time this evening. I know you have other callers, but thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your phone call. Let me go back to the phone lines. Lynette calling from Northeast D.C. Lynette, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'm calling to comment on the legislation for the assisted suicide. And I just think we've become a world of instant gratification, you know, pop liposuction to lose weight instead of working out and, you know, such as that, and now being assisted with death. And life is a process. We're born, we live, and we die, no matter how long that takes. And being from a Christian family and believing in the Bible and God, there's no assistance with that. There should be no assistance, whether it's the person who's in enduring the suffering or the family making the decision. God suffered. I mean, Jesus got on that cross, hung his head, he was tormented, and he suffered. So whatever suffering we all get, you know, it may sound cruel and horrible, but I feel that whatever suffering we get in our lifetime, we should be able to go through that suffering till death, until it's time for us to move on to the next life. So,
Lynette, if I may, Mary Che, Ward 3 council member, Mary Che was the original sponsor of this legislation. But go ahead and finish your point, please.
Oh, okay. So that's pretty much my point. I mean, and I guess just everybody probably doesn't have the same, you know, religious beliefs, but, you know, being a Christian, this is what I feel. I just feel it's suicide. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's called assisted suicide, but it's suicide just yet. And if you believe in the Bible, suicide is wrong. So that's just the comment I wanted to make.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Mr. Chairman, did you want to make a comment about her last comment?
No, it's clearly she, and she's not the only one who's called tonight, feels very strongly, and it's a religious-based view. And the legislation doesn't change that.
Okay. Andre, calling from Virginia. Thanks for calling, Andre. What's on your mind?
So I had a question as far as how will the insurance policies be held up if you take your own life? Because a lot of policies have those clauses in there.
That's an interesting question.
It is, but remember, this is at the end stage of life, and I don't know offhand how the insurance policies address that. I do know that there were some amendments today that were the result of working with the insurance industry to reflect a better bill.
Mm-hmm. And certainly between now and I would imagine that final vote, there may be some opportunities to do some fine tuning, perhaps.
Yeah, but I think that was what was. You see, the bill came out of committee maybe 3 weeks ago, and then it went to what we call a committee of the whole for agendizing. And then, so it's, there have been several opportunities already, and that resulted in the amendment today to reflect issues that the insurance industry raised.
Okay. Andre, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I want to move on to another issue, certainly for our listeners who want to ask any question or share any concern, whether it's about this particular bill, Death with Dignity, or any other issue in the district. You're certainly welcome to join the conversation. I want to talk a little bit about D.C. statehood. You had some thoughts as we move. We are 1 week away from electing a new president, and depending on, you know, who that person is, may determine the course of D.C. statehood. Your thoughts about that?
Well, it's timely that you ask, because there is on the ballot in the district a referendum, an advisory referendum, that asks voters whether they support the government petitioning, going forward and petitioning Congress for statehood for the district. Now, this isn't a new idea, but it is a new or renewed push. The council adopted, actually what we did was by resolution approve a constitution that is different and I think an improvement on a document that was adopted in 1987 by the council, which was different and at the time thought to be an improvement on a constitutional convention in 1982. And so we have that. We have boundaries that the council's adopted, which exclude what you would expect, the Capitol, the White House, the Federal Triangle. And what our intent is with the new government in January, there'll be a new Congress, maybe a Congress in different hands, but that doesn't matter. It'll still be a new Congress, and there'll be a new president, that we petition a new government and say, look, we are the only citizens of the United States who don't enjoy all the rights and responsibilities of the citizens of the 50 states. And the only way we can do that is through statehood. This would put an end to congressional interference. It would give us full representation in Congress, which we don't have now. It would end the, I don't know if I want to call it irony or hypocrisy, that Congress makes many decisions for us, and yet we have no vote in either house.
With this ballot, how much teeth does this ballot issue, you know, really have?
Well, it doesn't by itself give us statehood. It doesn't.
Obviously,
so in that
true.
Sense, it has no teeth.
Mm-hmm.
But assuming that the vote will be this time similar to what it's been other times and what polls have shown, it'll be a significant majority that will say, yes, we support statehood. And so we go to Congress and we say, and this was the mayor's thinking, and I give her credit for this. It's called the Tennessee Plan, although we're not exactly following the Tennessee Plan. Rather than going to Congress and saying, Congress, please give us statehood, and then Congress says, okay, we'll give you statehood, but you have to come up with the Constitution and boundaries. And we instead say, hey, look, we've had the referendum. We have a Constitution document. We have boundaries. We've taken all these steps. We're presenting the package to you. Now approve it.
We
are the only national capital of a free world country where the citizens of the national capital do not have representation in the national legislature.
I need to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Jerry, calling from Southeast D.C. Jerry, stay with us. We'll be talking to you on the other side. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking to D.C. Council Chair Phil Mendelson. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. We're sitting down with D.C. Council Chairman Phil Mendelson, talking all things about the District of Columbia. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Jerry calling from Southeast D.C. Jerry, thanks for hanging on. What's on your mind? Jerry, are you there? Jerry? Jerry, give us a call back if you can, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Jerry did want to talk about affordable housing, so I will ask my question about that. And what is going on with affordable housing in the District of Columbia? Time and time again, it is still one of the biggest water cooler discussions here in the district. New apartments going up. And as a native Washingtonian, I must say that I am somewhat aghast at just how expensive it is. I live in Baltimore because I cannot afford to live here. Is there any kind of plan to at least try to provide some sense of balance?
Well, it's a real challenge, and it's also one of the top political issues in the city. People who feel that they're being forced out of their homes because they can't afford to live in the city. And also, I think from a public policy perspective, and this is what a lot of people feel, that the economic diversity is important to having a healthy city and a vibrant city. We have a number of strategies in place. One of them is that we've substantially increased the funding for what's called the Affordable Housing Production Trust Fund, HPF. And the Housing Production Trust Fund is targeted to low and extremely low and low income housing, whether it's rental or for purchase. But we have other strategies as well. We have the lowest residential real property tax rate in the region. And then on top of that, it's what we call progressive. Because of the homestead deduction, if you live in your home, you actually you get a break, an additional break there, which is a greater percentage of your income if you are a lower income, just because you tend to have a less affluent house. And the homestead deduction, I'm sure I'm making this too confusing here. The homestead deduction is a flat, I believe, $70,000 taken off the value of the house. So if you live in a $300,000 house, that's roughly 25% of the value. Mm-hmm. If you live in $1 million house, that's less than 10% of the value. That's why I say that it's more targeted to lower income people. We have what's called Schedule H, which is on the income tax. It's for renters who get a credit on their real property tax. It would also be for homeowners. They get a credit. It's a refundable credit. And we've lowered the income tax rate for the lower brackets. We have the most progressive income to personal or individual income tax in the country. And progressive means that lower income people pay a smaller share of their income toward income tax than wealthy people. And in fact, the tax breaks that the council adopted a couple years ago, which are being phased in, actually resulted in a tax increase for those who are over $500,000 or $1 million in income, mm-hmm. and an increase in the earned income tax credit for those people under, I believe it's $20,000. So it's real. It's another one of the strategies. We have inclusionary zoning for new residential projects that there has to be a percent set aside for low income. We've increased where the city has property that we're disposing, and there's going to be residential development. There has to be, it's either 20 or 30% that's for extremely low and low income people.
Now, with that said, on one hand, as I started this particular conversation, that it's very expensive in the district, and some people may feel squeezed out. The other side is it's very expensive to live here, and that there seems to be no shortage of people who are willing to afford to live in expensive.
That's true.
So what does that say about the economic health and future of the district as we are seeing more people who can or are at least willing to try to afford the higher cost of living?
I'm not sure I understand the question, but if it's only about the economic health of the city mm-hmm. itself, the city government.
Well, not the government, but the city at large.
Having lots of rich people live here is great for the city, for the economic.
That's it. You understood the question.
But that's not all of it. All of it is that we want stability. We don't want people to be forced out for economic reasons that are due to the big economy, not the household economics. And I think economic diversity is important. It creates a better rounded population. Also, I mean, there are a lot of ways of looking at this. Environmentally, the low-income worker who has to drive for 20 miles, that's not good for – it means more roads. It means more air pollution. And it also isn't good for them economically because there's a cost to that travel as well as the time that's spent. I mean, there's so many reasons why we don't want the folks who have the minimum wage job to have to live in Prince William or in Howard County. They should be living in the core of the region.
With that said, and you make an excellent point about, you know, the, you know, the D.C. Metro's working class. Metro, as we know, has is looking at, once again, raising rates, reducing services, and it just seems to have a myriad of issues as it deals with these surges. What is your opinion about how things are going with Metro? Pardon the pun. Is it on the right track?
I think it's on the right track to get better, but it's going to require sustained endurance with the challenges, whether that's SafeTrack or whether that is folks having to pony up more dollars, which I think ought to be the jurisdictions and not the riders, I mean, just the many different challenges that we have, whether we're riders or we're government officials who have to appropriate dollars, that it's going to take several years before this starts to turn around. I shouldn't put it that way. It's going to take several years before we actually see the significant improvement that I believe we are on the right track. I have to say I'm disappointed in the proposed budget for next year, but I also recognize it's early in the process, and I also am not on the Metro board, so I don't know the dynamic of the decision process. I think typically the general manager's proposed budget starts out with a lot of criticism, and out of that comes the crafting of a better budget. And if that's the normal process, we're going through that now. But I don't want to see large fare increases, maybe saw a small increase because there hasn't been an increase in several years. I think that the organization, that the bureaucracy has not been as adroit. So there probably need to be some changes and some, tightening or streamlining there. The jurisdictions are going to have to come up with more money, though. We have just – what we are experiencing with Metro is not just the result of what happened in the last couple of years. This is a result of a couple of decades of neglect by the region.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Jerry calling from Southeast. Jerry, thanks for calling back. What's on your mind?
Oh, thank you so much. Sure. Good afternoon, everybody. Good evening, should I say. I wanted to say I was one of the first recipients of the TAL program in the 1990s. And when John Ray introduced that bill, he had many trying to fight him to snatch away the program. Well, I was one who went to testify. And not only because of my testimony did they keep the program, but they allocated more money for the program. Since then, I have moved on. I have a two-time home buyer out in PG County. And the reason I want to speak out is because I see now that my daughter has a voucher. And the voucher is, thank God she has something. We're very grateful for that. But we see where she's redlined because everywhere she tries to move, the landlords are saying, well, you don't have enough on your voucher. And it's like she's stuck in a situation where she can't move. So I wanted to say, because I know I am one who didn't stay on the welfare roads, didn't stay on the Section 8 roads, that there is hope, and some of us do move on. I believe that there's a mindset today that these girls are not going to go no further than you let them go. So we're just going to give them anything. But I'm proof that some of us do move on. I actually still have the letter that I gave my Section 8 social worker asking her to take me off Section 8. And I'm not going to lie, because of some of my economic situation sometimes, I wish I had kept the letter in my drawer. But again, I moved on. And some of us will move on. And I think the officials need to know that some of these girls would move on and not just redline them and say, oh, you're not going anywhere, so we're just going to stick you in Southeast. Your voucher is worth this. Good luck with it.
Well, Jerry, I'm running out of time, and I'd like to at least have the chairman, you know, speak to your thoughts as far as they've been so far.
Well, I'm hearing a couple of things. One of them is that there should not be any redlining. There just shouldn't be. And the second thought that what I heard suggests that we should be concentrating low-income folks in Southeast. I completely disagree with that. I think that there's enormous value in having that diversity throughout. And one of the things I like about what's called inclusionary zoning is that you take an apartment building that may be middle or income residents, and you have a percentage of apartments that are for lower income folks mixed in, not apartment A is going to always be the low income apartment, but it's mixed. I think that's good for everybody. And I'm trying to think, what else did I hear in that?
She was saying that she has moved on despite
what's a lot of
and
people.
And that could be commendable,
that.
I certainly think.
Totally, and that's exactly mm-hmm. what we want to have happen. We don't want people who are dependent on the government forever. We want folks who are able to stabilize their situation and grow from that. I guess I also heard that the voucher program is supposed to be the difference between something like 30% of your income and what the market rate is for that unit. That's what it's supposed to be.
Well, Jerry, thank you so much for sharing with us. I'm going to have to end the conversation there, that we are out of time. But I want to thank D.C. Council Chair Phil Mendelson for sharing
thank
with
you.
Us. There's so many other things that we could talk about, and certainly we will be in touch as always. So again, thank you so much for sharing with us this evening.
Thank you.
That is the Daily Drum on Sirius.